Okay, recorder's on, yeah. This is World Affairs Monthly, and I have on the line Mr. Kishore Mahbubani. In fact, Professor Kishore Mahbubani. And he doesn't really need an introduction. He's a very famous diplomat and from Singapore, of course. He spent about 30 years in the foreign ministry, and he was actually at the United Nations for quite a long time and even president of the Security Council. And then, of course, after he left the foreign ministry, he went to the National University of Singapore, where he was dean and also a professor of public policy. Professor, thanks so much for this chance to talk to you. Now, of course, I didn't really know how I wanted to start this discussion, but you know what? I'll say this to begin. Westerners have been going to China for, you know, more than 1,000 years, you know, going over there, taking a look, you know, talking to people, you know, looking into the place. But, you know, the Chinese have never necessarily been all that interested in Western life, and you know, they didn't really reciprocate. And then, of course, the change took place with Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger. It seems to me that they wanted to play the Chinese off the Soviet Union. You know, this was probably what was going on. That's why I want to get your expertise on this. And of course, they did really open up China. And, you know, in the same respect, the American Navy opened up Japan, but of course, Japan didn't have its large population at the time. Back then in the 19th century, you know, so we opened up China, you know, trillions of people, 4 trillion people, I'm joking around, but, you know, a large population. And now we're, of course, realizing, oh, well, we opened up China. That's sort of a problem. Okay, so how's that for the first question?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. The United States' decision to, in a sense, recruit China to join its camp in the Cold War against the Soviet Union, the move made by Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger, was a brilliant geopolitical move.
Mm-hmm.
And it changed the course of world history. And, of course, in some ways, the American engagement eventually also led to China's remarkable decision to turn around its policies. As you know, China had in one way or another isolated itself from the rest of the world for a long time,
mm-hmm.
in fact for several hundred years. And then finally, Deng Xiaoping decided in 1979 that by isolating itself from the world, China had fallen behind, and that by engaging the world, China would leap ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he launched his four modernizations in 1979. And of course, what's happened since then has been remarkable, because in 1980, in purchasing power parity terms, the U.S. economy was 10 times larger
yeah.
than that of China. But by 2014, in purchasing power parity terms, the U.S. economy had become smaller.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this one change showed that the decision by Deng Xiaoping to open up the economy and to join the world was a brilliant and
yes.
a wise decision that
yes.
he made.
Yes, and I noted what, you know, this is probably 30 years ago, whenever, 25 years ago, before I went to China with my wife in the mid-90s, 1990s, that Deng Xiaoping did study as a young man in France. And I thought that was really interesting, you know. So he had exposure to Western ideals and Western ways, and you know, Western scholarship. So I thought that was. Do you agree that would have been very important?
Yes, I think what you're absolutely right. Deng Xiaoping was a remarkable man, and I think Professor Ezra Vogel of Harvard University has written a very good biography of him.
Okay.
I think he will go down in history as the greatest leader of the 20th century, because he single-handedly
mm-hmm.
Improved the livelihood of 1 billion people
yes.
In China with his decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And what he did was that he asked himself a very simple question, Deng Xiaoping. Why is it that the Chinese who went overseas, whether they went to Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, or even those who went to United Kingdom and USA, mm-hmm. why were they so prosperous overseas? But why were the Chinese inside China not succeeding?
Yeah.
And of course, he realized that the economic system of China was failing. So he decided to go from centrally planned state-run economics to free market economics.
Mm-hmm.
And that one decision amazingly woke up the Chinese people and gave them incentives to join the market economy. And then since then, China has become the fastest growing economy in the world for over 40 years now.
Yes, and you know, I think that's an excellent observation, because last night my son and I, Christoph, you'll have to talk to him sometime, he's quite interested in these kind of things. We were discussing how nationalism can kind of, you know, get out of hand. And for example, he pointed out that I think it was in the 1890s that Korea tried to, well, actually did simplify their language and created an alphabet. And I think that, you know, the Chinese were able, with Deng Xiaoping's leadership, were able to look beyond this nationalism that they've, you know, kind of allowed to flourish for a long time, thousands of years. And, you know, they stayed isolated. They were open to new ideas, and they were saying, well, you know, maybe we need to do something here, right? Does that make sense to you?
Oh, yes. I mean,
Western influence.
You know, it probably wasn't easy for Deng Xiaoping to persuade his colleagues in the Chinese Communist Party, who under Mao had learned to distrust the capitalist societies. It probably wasn't easy for him to persuade them that they had to make a radical U-turn and give up the kind of centrally planned state-run economy that had been the feature in China from 1949 to 1979. But the most famous saying of Deng Xiaoping is a saying which says that it doesn't matter whether a cat is black or a cat is white. If it catches mice, it is a good cat.
Okay, I like that, yes.
So that was a brilliant way of saying, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's communism or capitalism.
Yes.
Whichever works, we use it. So since capitalism was doing much better at generating economic growth, he said go for capitalism.
Now, I like that. Now, Mark, as I said earlier, Marco Polo and numerous Westerners, you know, went over to China. The Jesuits went over to China very early on. And there wasn't, like I said, there wasn't much reciprocation, you know, right? Is that correct? I mean, so the Chinese have been isolated and like to be isolated. But now, like you say, with Deng Xiaoping, this has changed. And we now have as Lee Kuan Yew, your prime minister for 30 years or so in Singapore, I think Mr. Lee Kuan Yew had said, well, now we have changed the world. You know, China is in economic development, rapid development. And I noticed that in the mid-90s, and I predicted it would be very, very successful. So now are we in trouble? I'm not sure. You know, and I wanted to mention that you have got a new book out, of course. I'm not going to forget that. Has China won? So you're effectively arguing that we have to come to some agreement. You know, modus vivendi, that's a fancy word for it. We have to realize that there has to be some kind of modus vivendi. And I wanted to simply propose, and I'll stop here in a moment, that if we have a balance of power, or, you know, the impolite way to put it is mutual assured destruction, probably we won't, my son and I were discussing it, we probably won't have war, you know, because we could destroy them, they could destroy us, and we'll just kind of leave each other alone. But of course, on the other side is my friend Jim O'Neill. I haven't talked to him in a long time, of Goldman Sachs. He and I have been in touch for a long time, decades. And, of course, he saw, along with me, that, you know, opening up China was going to be pretty impressive operation. And so you have this, like you just said, Kishore, earlier, the United States economy is going to be quite, I wouldn't say small compared to China, but eventually it will be somewhat smallish compared to China. So effectively, what do you recommend as a veteran diplomat, you know, trying to get people to calm down? What do you actually recommend, in, you know, in light of by the way, if you could summarize the thesis of your book, that would be very interesting, you know, for the audience.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. You know, the reason why I came out with this book, Has China Won at This Time? Is that the United States has decided to launch a major geopolitical contest against China without first working out a comprehensive long-term strategy. And of course, it's a mistake for any country to launch a contest without working out a strategy. And the man who gave me this insight was the man we mentioned earlier, Henry Kissinger, the man who engineered the new policy of United States towards China. And I had a one-on-one lunch with him in New York in March 2018.
Okay.
And I got his permission to put, if you read the introduction to the book, you find I cite what he said to
me
with his permission. But another man who was a great American strategist whom I cite in my book was George Kennan. And George Kennan said that before America embarks on this huge contest against the Soviet Union, it had to work out some key principles on how to manage this competition. So, for example, he advised that America should remain humble. He advised that America should focus on increasing its domestic productivity and improving the condition of its people. He emphasized that America should build up allies in its competition against the Soviet Union. And he also said that the United States should not insult the Soviet Union, because if you insult a country, then you will not be able not be possible for you to talk to them.
Sure.
And what's interesting is that all these pieces of advice that George Kennan gave for America to use against the Soviet Union also apply to dealing with China. And none of these principles or pieces of advice given by George Kennan have been utilized by the current U.S. Administration. So that's why my goal is at the my book is at the end of the day a gift to the American people, because my message to them is, please think very carefully before you embark on this geopolitical contest against China, because at the end of the day, China is a country with four times the population of America, and equally importantly, it's a 5,000-year civilization that America is dealing with, and America is only 250 years old. So it'd be wiser for America to be prudent and careful rather than reckless and belligerent in its dealings with China.
Now, that's true, but can we really expect, you know, you're an academic and been a professional diplomat. I've been mostly a academic I don't know what you want to call myself, but I have not been a professional like you, but can you really get people to listen to you? You know, you can try, but are they going to listen, because they're full of emotions and anger and frustration, right? Deng Xiaoping was able to overcome that, but do you see that happening here in the United States?
Well, I think that's precisely why I tried to write a fair and objective book. I mean, there's some of the reasons why Americans are angry against China are justified. So in my very first substantive chapter, I talk about China's biggest strategic mistake in dealing with America. And China's biggest strategic mistake was to alienate the American business community, which had been investing in China and doing well in China. But especially after the 2008-2009 financial crisis, some Chinese became a bit arrogant and began to make unreasonable demands on American businessmen. And this is why when President Trump launched his trade war against China, not a single American businessman tried to stop him and say, stop, stop, you know?
Yeah, it resonated. Yeah, it resonated to some degree.
That you shouldn't launch this contest against China because China is our biggest, the biggest market for our product. So I do try to be fair in the book. I talk about the mistakes that China has made and also the mistakes that America has made in dealing with China. And, of course, the biggest mistake that America has made, as I said earlier, is that it hasn't tried to work out a comprehensive long-term strategy on how to deal with China.
Well, can you imagine China and the United States coming together and realizing that, like you say, mistakes have been made and, we've got to kind of, what do you want to say, modus vivendi or, work things out? I'm not so sure. I don't know.
Well, the thesis of my book is a somewhat paradoxical one, which is that a major geopolitical contest between the U.S. and China is both inevitable and avoidable. It's inevitable because, unfortunately, the logic of history teaches us that whenever the world's number one emerging power, which today is China, is about to overtake the world's number one power, which today is the United States, you inevitably get geopolitical tensions within the world's number one power and the world's number one emerging power. So the geopolitical contest you see between U.S. and China is something that could be predicted by anybody.
Sure.
But at the same time, I also say it's avoidable because if the primary goal of the U.S. government is to improve the well-being of the 330 million American people rather than to retain its primacy in the world, then it would make sense for China and for America and China to work together to increase the prosperity of their people, and this is still feasible. At the same time, both America and China face common global challenges. They face the common global challenge of global warming, and today, as you can tell, they face a common global challenge of COVID-19. So there are many reasons why the United States and China
could unify
working together rather than engage in a zero-sum geopolitical contest in which both sides will lose.
I suppose that's true. Now, it occurred to me when I was waking up in my bed, I said, okay, what's the first question I want to ask? And I had too many of them, but I delayed this one. So when you're speaking to audiences, Kishore, you're wherever you are, and someone gets up and boldly says, what about these trade imbalances? You know, what typically will you say? large trade imbalances.
I would say modern economics, especially the economics that is taught in the leading American universities and the leading Western universities or Western-style universities is economics written by American professors. And American professors have taught us that you should not focus on the trade imbalances because trade imbalances are not the result of any unfair trading practices. Imbalances are the result of an imbalance between savings and spending in any economy.
Okay.
So, for example, after President Trump imposed tariffs on China, if America's trade deficit with China went down, it would automatically go up with the rest of the world because the trade imbalance was not the result of unfair trading practices. It's the result of the imbalance within saving and spending.
Okay.
And at the same time, America is the luckiest country in the world because when other countries have trade imbalances, they have to borrow money to pay for an excess of exports over imports. America is the only country in the world that can print money to pay for excess of imports over imports. And this is what and I say this in the book, a former French minister called it an exorbitant privilege that Americans enjoy because they have the global reserve currency.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of complaining about global trade imbalances, Americans should celebrate the fact that they can enjoy trade imbalances by just printing money.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Now, the British enjoyed that as well. And what about the, you know, the historian will say, well, these empires, these formidable empires, like, for example, the British Empire, they eventually come to an end, right? Could you give me your thoughts about that? You know, aren't we really looking at that kind of situation? You know, the United States has been preeminent now for, in fact, I remember reading, I can't remember the historian, you know, but I think it was de Tocqueville, maybe, who said that he came over to the United States, and he said that he was astonished that Paris was lit up pretty well, you know, by lights, and it was prosperous, but Philadelphia probably was arguably more prosperous and more lit up by lights, you know. It's quite amazing, right?
Well, you know, I don't see an absolute decline for the United States of America.
Yeah.
I remain very confident and optimistic
that
America as a society will do very well in the coming decades. And so just because economic growth is not a zero-sum game,
mm-hmm.
so just because the Chinese economy becomes bigger in relative terms,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't mean that the American economy will become smaller in absolute terms.
Okay.
I believe that the American economy can continue to grow and do well, and the American people can continue to have better and better living standards. But as you know, the real tragedy in America, which I point out in my book, is that America is the only major developed country where the average income of the bottom 50%
mm-hmm.
has gone down over a 30-year period.
Yes, yes,
and that's very shocking.
Yeah.
And that shows that that America's real problems
mm-hmm.
are not due to external causes, but to internal causes.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in the contest between the United States and China, one thing that United States should watch out for is that while United States sees the competition within a dynamic democracy in America and a rigid communist party in China, in reality, the contest may be between a plutocracy in America
mm-hmm.
and a meritocracy in China.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a contest within a plutocracy and a meritocracy, the meritocracy may do better than the plutocracy.
I agree. I have to brag and say I saw that coming in the mid-90s. Well, you know, Singapore was a fairly good example of that, right? Lee Kuan Yew touted this idea of meritocracy, and of course, how well has Singapore done? It's done pretty well, exactly, right?
And in fact, China learned the lessons of meritocracy from Singapore.
Yeah,
in many ways.
Exactly. Now, I did send off a tweet last night where I listed, I thought it was kind of interesting to list these five potential topics, and I want to discuss your book thesis more, but let me just go through these quickly. So the number one issue I raised is there's an author named William C. Hanas, and he's not very well known perhaps, but he argued that one of the reasons, or one of the principal reasons, the Chinese nation didn't necessarily, you know, build out as quickly as the Westerners is because their language is difficult. And in fact, he cites evidence that the elite, you know, for many thousand years or so, actively encouraged the complexity of the language. And of course, we don't really have an alphabet. You know more about it than I do. And he argued plainly in his book that you know, this is a major problem. And of course, you know, have the Chinese accepted this, or you know, what would you say about this, Kishore?
Well, I think it would be a huge mistake to underestimate the strength and vitality of Chinese civilization, because
mm-hmm.
China is the world's oldest continuous civilization. Continues for 5,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And Professor Wang Gungwu, who's one of the leading historians in Asia today, has said that the Chinese civilization is the only civilization that has been knocked down four times and stood up four
mm-hmm.
times.
Mm-hmm.
So it would be a huge mistake to underestimate the strength and resilience of Chinese civilization. Mm-hmm. So, and the fact that they've been able to get along without an alphabet for so many years shows that the absence of an alphabet is not an impediment to China's growth and success.
True, but we do have to acknowledge that since 1450 or so, the Chinese nation has fallen behind, gradually fallen behind, and of course, in the last 150 years, before Deng Xiaoping and Mao Zedong and these men, China was in a pretty miserable state of affairs, right? And was so bad that the Chinese realized, oh my goodness, we got to do something. But you agree that for the Western ascendancy,
I would say the Chinese until 1820. Which means for 1800 of the last 2,000 years, the two largest economies in the world were always those of China and India.
Mm-hmm.
So it's only in the last 200 years that Europe has taken off and America has taken off.
Mm-hmm.
So if you view the past 200 years of world history against the backdrop of the past 2,000 years of world history, the past 200 years of Western domination of world history, as I document in my book, Has the West Lost It,
mm-hmm.
has been a major historical aberration. So all aberrations come to a natural end.
Mm-hmm.
So it's perfectly natural to see the return of China and India. And you're absolutely right that China suffered what the Chinese call a century of humiliation from the Opium Wars of 1842 to the establishment of the People's Republic of China in 1949. But that century of humiliation has left deep scars on the Chinese psyche and has therefore motivated them to do very well and ensure that China is never again humiliated in the way that it was during the century of humiliation.
No question. Now, like I said, the efforts of Westerners to go over there. Oh, actually, I remember I was pretty surprised when I read that, this is a long time ago, decades ago, I read that Western doctors, American doctors and European doctors went over to China and showed them how to do surgery, I would also point out that I think it's probably true that, maybe in 1800 or, somewhere around that time, most Chinese people, maybe even 90% were illiterate. Would that be an exaggeration?
You're absolutely right. In fact, the Chinese have learned a lot from the West. And I think one basic mistake that the Chinese made was to ignore the tremendous advances in science and technology that the West had made in previous centuries. So I think the Chinese are determined to ensure that in the field of science and technology, they don't fall behind.
Right.
And you also made another very important point that 80 to 90% of the Chinese people were illiterate for most of Chinese history.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what that means, by the way, is that for most of Chinese history, 80 to 90% of Chinese brains were not used.
That's right.
But today, if you go to China, 100% of Chinese brains are being used.
Yes.
So if China is now harvesting the best brains from 1.4 billion people, and that's what a meritocracy does, it'd be a mistake to underestimate what China can do with 1.4 billion people.
Of course. That's probably the thesis of your next book, and I'm going to write about it right now when I get off the phone. Yeah, no, I think that's true. In fact, I do vaguely recall, as my travels through China were taking place in the mid-90s, I said, I realized that pre Mao Zedong and pre Communist Revolution, the illiteracy was just terrible, and I think they decided they were gonna end that, and so I think that's a major accomplishment by the Chinese. And then you have to ask yourself, Kishore, what exactly were the Chinese emperors doing? They were, I won't be too disparaging, but obviously they were quasi incompetent. And of course, you have this system going on for centuries, right? And there was a clear break with Mao Zedong, there was a clear break of with the past. In fact, I remember asking some Chinese people occasionally, as I traveled across China on buses and trains, and my wife and I were kind of puzzled. We were looking for the old China, the ancient China, historical China, and it didn't exist. They destroyed all of it, much of it. Is that correct?
I think what the Chinese experienced in their feudal conditions was similar to what Europe also experienced in its feudal conditions.
Okay.
Before the Industrial Revolution came along.
Mm-hmm.
So it was only the small feudal lords that enjoyed a comfortable life. But even they didn't enjoy as good a comfortable life
mm-hmm.
as the modern middle classes do, because their life expectancy was 40 to 50,
mm-hmm.
and they would have to suffer all kinds of diseases and so on and so forth.
Yeah, okay.
So thanks to Western science and technology, we
yeah.
can now live much longer and much better lives.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, what's happened is that the last 30 to 40 years, the improvements in the living standards that the Chinese people have experienced are the best that they have experienced in 4,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's important to emphasize that, because some people believe that the people of China are unhappy and about to overthrow the Chinese government.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the present Chinese government has done more to improve the living of the Chinese people, improve the standard of living of the Chinese people than any previous government has.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's true. Now, the second, I wanted to get through this list. So the second thing I wanted to mention and ask you about is, and I remember, again, back decades ago, realizing that the Chinese were apparently the first to develop a kind of a printing press. I think it might have been even a movable type. I there's not much known about it, and this was maybe 1100 AD. And I then there's so little known about it, but I did my best to investigate, and it seems that the emperor at the time, or the emperors, said no, we don't want this. And perhaps that was the turning point, because the Westerners with Mr. Gutenberg in 1455, I think it was, enormously catalyzed this very powerful expansion of knowledge. And of course, without the movable type printing press, you probably can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say?
I think we can go into all the historical arguments.
Yes. Okay.
But there's no doubt that the Chinese also accept the fact that they did fall behind the West significantly.
That's what I'm trying to
and
say.
And now,
yes.
Therefore, the Chinese have, as you know, made a powerful decision to learn from the West.
Mm-hmm.
And to carry on learning the best practices. So
sure.
For example, in the field of information technology, which is very much a Western technology. Today, if you want the best 5G information technology, you don't go to Europe. You go to America,
mm-hmm.
or America. You go
sure.
to China.
Sure. Exactly. So I think they have drawn some profound lessons from this, right? I mean, they're just not going to be so foolish in the
That's right.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so number three, we've touched on this already, but I actually say here the wonderful achievement of Chinese Communist Party to unify China and restore economic development. Of course, we don't need to discuss that much, mm-hmm. but you agree with that, right? There's no question mm-hmm. that was the turning point. Number four, of course, we've discussed this a little bit, mutual assured destruction doctrine. Probably means that Graham Allison is incorrect, and my son and I were just, Christoph, he's a wonderful boy, we were discussing that last night, he's really expert in this, he just said, well, if this is going to be a powerful doctrine, and it seems to be the case, then why would anybody, jeopardize the... If you know you're going to be pulverized, probably, you're not going to do anything.
Well, I think that's why. Actually, that's the reason why it's very unwise for the United States to think that the geopolitical competition with China will take place in the military arena, because you mm-hmm. and your son are right. The mutual assured destruction mad means that if you have a nuclear war, there will not be a winner and a loser.
Mm-hmm.
There will be a loser and a loser. And the winners will be the non-participating countries,
mm-hmm.
which will be India, Japan, Russia, and so on and so forth. So that's why it's very unwise to engage in this. That's also the main reason why I wrote this book at this time. I think I'll be on a panel, live panel with Graham Allison in about 1 hour's time.
Oh, good.
In a discussion organized by the China Institute in New York.
Oh, great.
And and Graham Allison actually, I must say, gave my book a wonderful endorsement.
Yes, I saw that.
It's a timely book that Americans should read.
Yeah.
So both he and I agree that it's very unwise to pursue this military competition because it's not going to be a win-win proposition for either United States or China.
Mm-hmm. Now, my son Christoph pointed out last night, you really ought to talk to him. He's just really outstanding. He pointed out that, well, you know, Mr. Allison, a very impressive intellect, of course, but he pointed out that Mr. Allison is referring to historical examples, right? And maybe, you know, maybe this mutual assured destruction MAD doctrine didn't necessarily apply in those days. Is that would that be an argument you could make? I think that's probably correct.
Yes, I think to some extent Graham would also say that because
he would agree.
He says that a war should be avoided between U.S. and China.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Then I think Christoph was just really really persuasive when he said, "Look, we have these destructive weapons. You know, you can't imagine how destructive they are compared to say 100 years ago, right?" I think we all saw that with Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You just completely wipe out, you know, an entire city. So, and it's the precision guided munitions as well. So I don't know. It's kind of foolish when you start saying, Kishore, I'm sure you agree. When you start trying to predict a future, you know, you're going to look pretty stupid.
Sure.
But you never know. I mean, I told my son, I said, you never know.
Yeah.
We're thinking MAD will work, but you never know, right? I mean, we could have a conflagration. You never know.
Mm.
What do you say to that? The fact that there's always a possibility.
I think that we should treat nuclear weapons with a lot of respect.
Yeah.
And realize that if the primary goal of a government is to protect the lives and well-being of its people,
mm-hmm.
it should try to ensure that it doesn't use these nuclear weapons. And in fact, if you read Graham Allison's book, in his opening pages, he describes how tormented President Kennedy was over the prospect of having to use nuclear weapons. Because he knew that hundreds of millions of people could die
mm-hmm.
if such weapons were used between the United States and the Soviet Union. So I think we should therefore work towards a world where there's nuclear disarmament rather than work towards a world where there's nuclear rearmament.
Well, that's very interesting. I'm glad you said that because isn't it a paradox that maybe we have these weapons to be never used? We don't want to eliminate them because they're actually weapons that will never be used. Isn't that the interesting paradox?
I think you don't have to eliminate them, but you don't have to have 10,000.
Oh yeah,
of them.
Yeah, yeah, yes,
if,
of course.
500 and what is interesting is that the United States has 6,000 nuclear weapons and China has 300.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Supposedly, right? I mean, I agree. Well, look, okay, now, what about this, and I haven't really raised this issue yet, and I don't want to keep you longer than you want, so you tell me when you want to go, if you're going to talk to Graham Allison. But
maybe in another 5 minutes.
Okay, fine. The last question would be, how about this view of China as pursuing controlled economic development. I don't know how you want to put it. You know, the national economic development, and then you have on the other side, you have this Western view that, you know, the corporation is kind of ruling the world, and the state doesn't tell the corporation what to do. You know, we have more free market. So the Chinese are now convinced, I argued this in 1996, that way of thinking about economic development, I actually said development. dictatorship. I mean, it probably people didn't like it, mm-hmm. but that's what it is. And to some degree, so what would you say about that, Kishore, before you go off to your exciting conversation with Graham Ellison?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the best answer is the one given by the Nobel laureate, the Harvard professor, Amartya Sen.
Okay.
He said, for societies to succeed, you need the invisible hand of free markets.
Okay.
But you also need the visible hand of good governance.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the mistakes that was made by United States and United Kingdom and other places was that they succumbed to the Reagan-Thatcher revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, President Ronald Reagan said very famously, government is not the solution, government is the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so since then, there has been a progressive dismantling of the public agencies of the United States of America. And as a result of that, you've seen all the problems that have come up. You've seen the failure of the Federal Aviation Administration to regulate the Boeing 737 plane.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've seen the failures of the FDA in managing the COVID-19 outbreak. What you need to have in any society, you certainly need to have strong free markets, but it's also important to have strong public agencies,
mm-hmm.
and that's something that I think that'll be the big lesson mm-hmm. from COVID-19 for all over the world.
Yeah, so the corporation should not necessarily call all the shots.
And
right?
In fact, it's not in the interest of the corporations to call all the shots,
mm-hmm.
because it's better for them to have an impartial regulator that creates a set of rules that apply equally to all companies, and
mm-hmm.
that's the best way to grow an economy.
Well, thanks so much, Kishore, and give my regards to the crowd there you're talking. So the China Institute and...
Yeah, it'll be a live webinar, and you can tune in.
Okay, great, yeah. And say hello to Mr. Ellison.
In about an hour or so.
Yeah. Well, my final thought here in question would be, what do you, if you want to make a prediction in the next 10 years, do you think things will calm down, or do you think we're going to see an escalation in tensions between China and the United States?
Well, I think that will depend on whether or not people read my book.
Okay.
China
yeah.
One.
Very good, yeah.
But seriously, I think if they read the book, they will see that the conclusion of the book is that we can have, unlike a nuclear war, which is a lose-lose proposition,
mm-hmm.
you can have a win-win arrangement between the United States and China,
mm-hmm.
where both sides work together and both sides work to improve the livelihood and well-being of their people.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, there are 6 billion people who live outside the United States and China, and these 6 billion people in the world do not want to get caught up in a major geopolitical contest within the U.S. and China.
Yeah, yeah. They don't want to be victims of it. Yeah. Okay. Well, Kishore, thanks so much. Enjoy talking to you.
When will this be published? When will this be released?
Yeah, hold on. Let me turn off the recorder here. Hold on. Okay.